True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
A local preacher's wife was found floating in the Cottonwood River by the Rocky Ford Bridge just outside of Emporia. She's a popular young woman. She's a mother of three. A teacher at the Emporia State University. 4 months later, the preacher's secretary is driving along. Her name is Lorna Anderson. She's got her husband and her kids in the back. And out of nowhere, a masked man appears and shoots Marty Anderson, ultimately killing him. So you've got these two deaths spaced 4 months apart in this really small town. People really start to take notice.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Happy New Year to all.
Early one Sunday morning, kayakers found the body of a woman floating in the shallow water of a river outside Emporia, Kansas. She was identified as Sandra Bird, the wife of a minister and the mother of three young children. Her station wagon appeared to have run off a gravel road near a bridge. She'd been ejected before it overturned into the river. Initially, the death of Sandy Bird was ruled an accident, but over the next 2 years, residents of the tranquil Midwest town were swept up in a twisted tale of adultery, lust, greed, and murder. Although they were suspicious, investigators could not prove that First Lutheran minister Tom Bird and his mistress, Lorna Anderson, had plotted to kill Tom's wife. 4 months later, Lorna's husband Marty would turn up dead. Lorna stood to collect over $200,000 in life insurance. Her attempt to collect the money the day after Marty's death further raised some eyebrows.
Well, that might, don't you think?
I think so.
He's barely dead, and you're asking about the payout?
Well, you know, she had a family to support.
Ah, absolutely.
When an ex-boyfriend of Lorna came along and told police that Lorna and Tom had tried to hire him to kill Marty, all of the pieces began falling into place. The relationship of Tom Bird with his church secretary would surface as the core motive for these two untimely deaths. At the quiet end today, we learn about the forbidden romance and cold-blooded motives of two people who chose murder over divorce, death over life, and their own desires over anything that got in their way. Join us for Thou Shalt Not Kill, the murders of Sandy Bird and Martin Anderson, and our beer guys here with a great beer.
The beer guy, that's me. I have a beer called Fuzzy Knuckles. Nice name, isn't it?
Very nice. I like it.
Didn't you say one time you'd like to come up with the job of naming beers for a beer company?
Oh, I think that it sounds like a great job. I probably did.
You thought that would be one of those really cool jobs.
Yeah, it would be.
Anyway, Fuzzy Knuckles is an imperial stout brewed by Defiance Brewing Company out of Hayes, Kansas. It's a dark black beer with a thin head that does kind of last for a while. Very nice aroma of chocolate and roasted malt. Very nice taste, even better. Baker's chocolate, kind of that bittersweet chocolate taste.
Yummy, I like that.
Coffee, little molasses. This is a medium-bodied beer, and at 10% alcohol by volume, it's one to sip, not to chug.
Oh, okay.
But people don't go around chugging down imperial stouts anyway.
No, I think that's mostly the Buds and Michelobes.
That's right.
And Coors are the chuggers.
They are.
Yeah.
So this is a pretty nice beer. I think people would enjoy it. If you're a stout person, it'd be a good one to try.
Yeah, we had a great stout the other day. What was that one? At the restaurant when we went out for
the
pizza.
Evil Twin Mexican Biscotti
something.
Cake Break or something
yes,
like that.
Yes, that was delicious.
It was.
Where is Evil Twin out of?
New York.
Okay, so next New York murder. Let's do that one.
Okay.
Because I enjoyed that.
This was a collaboration, too, with Westbrook Brewing in Charleston.
Okay.
So
either one would work.
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm usually not a stout person, but that was absolutely delicious.
I was amazed. I know it was stout week at the restaurant, and you were kind of looking at either a stout or no beer, but I was amazed that you took that one.
I think they had me with biscotti. That's what drew me in.
Okay. Well, it worked.
Yeah, it did. It really did. So let's open it up and head on down to the quiet end.
Okay.
right.
And it is quiet down here. I guess it's the post-New Year letdown.
Well, yeah, everybody's probably still asleep.
They might be.
We came in fairly early.
We did. We wanted to do this so we could relax the rest of the day.
Well, yeah. And we did make it till midnight.
Yeah.
2018 starting off okay.
Yes, we saw it in.
Okay, well, let's get started.
Okay. So Sandy and Tom Bird moved to Kansas from Arkansas in 1982. Bird's assignment was to lead a congregation for the Lutheran Church in a small town of Emporia. Tom was a 32-year-old son of a minister who had two master's degrees in theology. He had unlimited energy and a seemingly endless charisma, which are some of the things you'd want to see in a successful preacher, right?
Well, maybe more of a televangelist, just the image I get.
Well, I don't know that he had that goal in mind.
Oh, yeah, he did.
He did?
He certainly did, yeah.
Okay.
Totally.
So some people would say that he seemed more like a salesman than a man of God.
Sure.
And that's what you said.
That's what I think.
Now, within a year of moving to Emporia, he had the church revitalized as an important part of the community. The church had started up a new daycare center. They also had a Bible study for children as well as adults. They had both softball and volleyball teams, and they had new families coming in every Sunday. So word traveled fast that this new preacher was a fireball.
Right, he's on fire. And then his wife, Sandy, she's petite. She's 32 years old, high energy, smart lady. She had this no-nonsense style with short brown hair, hardly any makeup ever, and she dressed very modestly. But Sandy was a lot more than a pastor's wife and the mother to her three small children. She also had a master's degree, and hers was in mathematics, which to me is more impressive.
I think so.
She was teaching and working on a second degree in computer math at Emporia State University.
So she's a brilliant woman.
Yes. She's probably too good for Tom, if we really think about it. Looking back.
You're already going back in time and saying, dump this guy.
All right. Well, after religion, Tom's passion was sports. He'd been a cross-country runner in college, and he still ran more than 5 miles a day. He was also very active in the church's softball team. His interest in sports was shared by Marty and Lorna Anderson, who Tom met at a church softball game.
Now, Marty Anderson met Lorna Slater when she was a student at Hutchinson Community College. Marty was from out of state, and he was studying to be a health technician at Grace Hospital. So they dated for a while and then married and moved to Emporia. Now, when the Andersons met Tom Bird, they had 4 young daughters and already a troubled marriage. Lorna was well known around town as someone who had had several affairs. Boy, that's a good reputation, huh?
Yeah, unusual.
Small town, and she's got 4 kids, but she likes to fool around.
Yeah, she reminds me a little bit of Candy Montgomery, because she was into the religion, and
yeah, you know,
it's funny.
It does.
It's funny we're doing these two so close together, because I see a lot of correlation there.
So Marty kind of was this fun-loving family man, outspoken, and his life revolved around his children. Lorna, however, was known as a flirty, sex-motivated femme fatale with a throaty voice, and she had a way of getting men to do what she wanted them to do. Oh, Lorna. She joked to friends over the years about killing her husband, and she eventually asked an attorney to prepare divorce papers, because probably that's better than killing him.
I think that was the best idea, yeah.
Now, according to Lorna, Marty refused to cooperate with the divorce because he wanted to be with his children full time.
Sure, but you don't have to cooperate.
No, you don't.
No.
Just do it.
Just do it. Both Lorna and Marty liked Tom Bird from their first meeting. He was charming. He was kind. Unlike many people in town, Tom didn't pass judgment on Lorna, and he invited her to come to the church with her family, and that's when she became involved in his Bible study.
Uh-oh.
When Tom hired Lorna as a part-time secretary, she found that he had a very sympathetic ear. She began confiding in him, and he was quite supportive. Lorna suffered from poor self-esteem, which makes sense, and she tried to make herself feel better by attracting men and taking on new lovers. Now, her relationship with Tom Bird progressed as most of her relationships with men did. By the spring of 1983, she and the pastor were lovers. He told Lorna that she was not what he needed in a wife, but that he could make her into what he needed.
Well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had quite an ego, I think.
I think it sounds like that.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I'm just thinking, if you're a woman that likes to stray outside your marriage, maybe you'd be better off in a larger city or something rather than a small town. Because your reputation's trashed.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in the church community itself. Yeah. I don't think the town was that tiny, but the church community was very small, like 200-300 people.
Not a good situation.
No, probably not very good for Marty either.
No. I guess he would be viewed more sympathetically, right?
Yeah.
He's this cuckold of a husband.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
Tom and Lorna became closer. Tom began confiding in Lorna about his dissatisfaction with his life. His growing congregation of First Lutheran was not enough for him. He had plans for a televised ministry that would reach millions of people. Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, well, I read that, actually. I can't just say that I figured that out on my own. I read that about him.
He and Lorna would watch Jimmy Swaggart and other televangelists, all the time dreaming of how great Tom could become if only they were free. Tom wanted to move to New Mexico to start his own ministry, which would be a much larger operation. In this type of ministry, he'd be offering counseling and classes in a large compound, and he would be a famous televangelist, as he believed they would be.
Yeah,
should be.
He actually believed he deserved that. He said he'd given so much to God that God owed him that. So he's got some problematic thought processes.
I guess.
Yeah.
And a man of God doesn't feel like he deserves anything.
Well, this one sure did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Tom didn't like that Sandy had her own career either. He felt like his career was the important one, and Sandy was not the supportive wife that he deserved. Lorna asked Tom to run away with her to New Mexico. She was in love with him, and she actually said she would give up everything to be with him, including her family. But for Tom, divorce was just not an option. The Byrds' marriage was strained by the demands of their careers and the three young children. Tom was frustrated when Sandy's job took her away from her household responsibilities, as he saw it. He wanted her to be more of a homemaker and an active member of the church. Sandy told a friend that she was afraid her husband didn't love her anymore. Shortly before her death, Sandy learned that she was being promoted and would have extra classes to teach at the college in the fall. She was hesitant to tell Tom because she was afraid he's going to react with anger. Surprisingly, Tom seemed pretty happy about the promotion when she first told him. On July 16, 1983, he took Sandy out to dinner and a movie to celebrate. Now they returned home briefly that Saturday at 9:30 p.m. Sandy ran into the house to grab a bottle of cold duck from the refrigerator for herself, and she grabbed a bottle of whiskey for her husband. She told the babysitter that they'd be back by 10:30.
So they got a bottle of some crap wine and a bottle of whiskey, and they're just going to be gone an hour.
I know, right? Right?
Sounds like a fun time.
Well, according to Tom, he and Sandy had been sharing a fun evening. Then he admitted that he wasn't really happy with the added responsibilities that Sandy would be taking on at the college. This would take away from the time she could spend with her role as the pastor's wife, which to him was much more important. He told Sandy that he was frustrated with all the time she spent away from him and from the church. So the night kind of took a sour turn at that point.
Yeah, this night of celebration, because he seemed pretty excited or happy about her good news, her promotion.
Yeah, that was just an act.
It was.
Right.
And then he's bitching about, oh, you need to spend more time with me at the church.
So he did admit to that, but then his story doesn't seem that believable after that. He says he decided to go back to the church to work on his sermon, and he said that Sandy told him she was going back to do some work on the college computer. Now, her friends would say that doesn't seem very likely that late at night.
Yeah, I mean, we're past 10 o'clock now.
Maybe, right.
Because they were going to be back home for the sitter by 10:30. So they're out. And then he decides to go to work on a sermon back to the church, and she's going to the college to do some work. I don't know.
So I guess they had some drinks at a local bar, and they left separately, Tom said. According to Tom, he finished writing his sermon and then went for a 5-mile run. So this was maybe a strange time to go running, since it's late at night.
We know he is a big runner.
Yeah, we do.
but that seems out of the ordinary.
Absolutely.
I mean, but you've been partying and drinking. I think I'll go for a run.
Well, he said it was to clear his head, but we've heard that story before, and I'm not sure I believe
it. Many times.
But, you know, it could be. It's not absolutely unbelievable.
So Tom knew that Sandy was unhappy, and he thought she might have gone for a drive on her own, because she's not home. He's waiting and worrying, and after a couple hours, he called the police. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, a policeman came to talk to Tom. Now, they initially weren't too concerned because Tom and Sandy had been arguing, so they just thought she was out somewhere cooling off. So on Sunday morning, Sandy was still not home. Then two police cars arrived at the house later that morning. One of them had Sandy's purse, and the police officers told Tom that Sandy's car had gone off the road and she had been found dead next to the car in the river.
Tom said he thought Sandy was working late at the college that night. He couldn't explain why she was driving in the area where she was found so late at night, though. This was an area 7 miles from their house where they had not driven before, according to Tom.
Yeah, so why? There's no real good reason for her to be there.
Exactly.
So Sandy's body had been found next to her Peugeot station wagon beneath the wood-planked Rocky Ford Bridge. Lyon County authorities said that she had missed a bend in the road and careened down an embankment into the river. Her death was accidental, according to police. Because, yeah, Tom's history, they'd been drinking.
Correct.
They separated. And I guess the story is that she might have been intoxicated and missed a curve and went off the road.
I think that's what he wanted them to think, yeah.
Now, of course, you have that little problem about her driving in an area where there's no reason for her to be driving in.
Sure.
So, but otherwise, yeah, I guess it sounds plausible, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Tom called Sandy's mom with the bad news, and she was shocked, of course. Tom said he felt guilty for the last conversation that he'd had with Sandy, where he'd complained about how much time she was putting into her career and all that, because he saw her primarily as a pastor's wife, and he said that he expected her to put God's work first. Now, local resident Dennis Arb heard about the fatal accident from his sister, who'd been listening to a police scanner. Dennis knew just about everyone in that area of town, so he rode his motorcycle down to the crash site to see if the fatality was someone he knew. Dennis showed up while police were still processing the accident site. It looked like the car had missed a curve and ended up in the middle of the river upside down. Dennis talked to police on the scene. They told him that her body had been found next to the car, as if she'd been ejected from the front seat. Dennis walked across the bridge, and he saw a dinner plate-sized puddle of blood on the ground near the railing. So this bridge is wood, and some of the blood had been absorbed into the wood. There were also drops of blood on the railing nearby.
And that would be, to me, a fairly good amount of blood. A dinner-sized puddle?
Yes.
Dinner plate-sized puddle?
Yeah, wasn't sure how much there was, but I actually saw a documentary on it where they talked to this Dennis Arb, and he showed with his hands how big it was, and it was about the size of a dinner plate.
So that's
suspicious a fair amount.
Stuff, yeah.
I thought so.
So he pointed out the blood to the officers who were on the scene, and they took samples, but they didn't think it was terribly suspicious. They thought it could have been fish bait blood or something else. Police did wonder what Sandy had been doing on the road there, and it made her mother suspicious. The other odd thing was that there are no skid marks where the car had gone over the bridge. Police thought maybe if she'd been drinking, and it was dark, she hadn't tried to stop.
So I could see that. Maybe she didn't know she was going off the edge. If she'd been drinking and it's dark in a foreign place,
I can see
that could happen.
Sure.
Marty Anderson, who was a member of the congregation and had been quite friendly with Tom, he worked as a medical examiner for the coroner's office. He was the one to tell Tom the cause of Sandy's death. Sandy had died from a transected left kidney, and she bled to death from the injury. So her death was determined to be accidental. So transected means her kidney was cut?
Right. Basically cut in half. That would have to be significant trauma to do that to a kidney. You'd have to have blows to the back.
Or if he threw her off the bridge and she landed on a rock or something. Could have done it.
Yeah, but you're getting ahead of yourself.
So if we go ahead 4 months after Sandy Bird's death, on a remote two-lane road nearby Geary County, Martin Anderson was shot to death. Now this scene was brutal. He was shot 3 times to the back of his head, and this looked like a cold-blooded execution. Lorna Anderson told investigators she was driving home with Martin and their 4 daughters, and she felt nauseous, so she pulled over the car and ran over to the grass to vomit. But she said she lost her keys, so she called Marty over to help to look for the keys, and she ran back to the car. She said as he was searching in the dark for the keys, a man in a ski mask appeared out of nowhere, and he told Martin to give him his wallet, and then fired 3 shots at him and killed him. Lorna said she ran and flagged down a passing car for help. Investigators searching the area found some casings from a .22 pistol, but Martin's wallet was missing.
Now, that's, to me, just an absolutely incredible story.
Yeah, let's poke some holes in that.
Sure. You want to do that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. So, first of all, why is she carrying her keys if she has to go vomit? Just leave the keys in the car.
Yeah, why would you even take them out of the ignition? He's sitting right next to you.
Yeah.
If you didn't feel well, why wouldn't you have him drive? That's another thing.
That's another thing. This was a fairly remote area, so why is somebody who's waiting to rob people in that particular spot?
Yeah.
That just doesn't work.
Well, I mean, it's a long shot, right?
Yeah, but that's her story.
That's her story. Now, Tom had an alibi. He was at a church seminar in Topeka, and he heard about Marty being killed. So the county sheriff was dubious, as we were.
Right. You know, how did the killer know that the Andersons' car would stop at that spot?
Exactly.
And they were questioning Lorna's story. Just wasn't believable that there was a robbery. Plus, her behavior also raised some eyebrows. The very next morning after Martin's death, she called her insurance agent to collect on Martin's policies. This is the police. This made her the primary suspect.
Sure.
So Emporia investigators had a breakthrough. They uncovered an earlier plot to kill Marty Anderson. Lorna had apparently paid a local building contractor, who also happened to be a former lover, $5,000 to kill her husband. The man handed off the money to someone else who said he would do the hit, but the guy ran off with the money without doing the job. Man also said that he didn't know who had actually followed through and killed Martin. But police found out that the money came from Tom. It was part of the proceeds from Sandy's life insurance.
Well, that's really something.
That's kind of convoluted, isn't it?
Well, you're going to take the life insurance proceeds from your wife that was killed to pay to kill your lover's husband.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
That's a lot.
Well, both Lorna and Tom were charged with criminal solicitation after that. Damaging evidence was uncovered about Lorna, and the people began to wonder why Pastor Tom was being so loyal to her. Rumors were spreading through town about a romance between the pastor and his secretary being the motive for these murders. The contractor testified at the trial that Tom had said, "I'm a man of God, and I'm going to kill Martin Anderson." But Tom would deny ever saying that.
That's a good move.
The denial?
The denial.
Yeah.
I never said that. Both the contractor and his brother had affairs with Lorna, so she really makes her way around town.
She did, but you know, that doesn't make her a murderer, so I don't think we should focus too much on that.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
But it was the widowed preacher's relationship with Lorna that drew the most suspicion. Witnesses described an electricity between the two, and said they even had pet names for each other.
Well, that's awfully suspicious, huh? They weren't very subtle.
No, they certainly weren't. So police interviewed all church members. Some reported seeing Lorna and Tom at a motel. One of the babysitters saw Lorna on top of Tom on a coffee table. Well, that's very suspicious.
The coffee table, yeah. Yeah. I wonder if the babysitter was sitting on the couch having coffee at the time. Or...
Yeah. She was just watching the kids. And, yeah. There's Lorna and Tom. Other people reported seeing the two kissing. So there's a lot of evidence that these two had been carrying on and having an affair.
Yeah, it wasn't a very well-hidden secret, was it?
No.
Investigators found 2 greeting cards from Tom in one of Lorna's bedroom drawers. "I love you, and I'm confident of the future, and that makes the present okay," he wrote. citing one card, "Love you always, Tom." But Tom, he would continue to deny that there ever was an affair. He even said that the cards only showed Christian love, not a romantic type of love. Police believed the phone records, though, would show how intense their relationship was. When Tom was staying with his mother-in-law, which is Sandy's mother, in the days before Sandy's funeral, he spent a good chunk of that time talking to Lorna on the phone. The week of the funeral, there were 6 to 7 phone calls a day made to Lorna from Tom. Tom said that the bond was just a deep friendship and two people supporting each other in difficult times. I mean, after all, they'd each lost a spouse. She needed him, he said, and he felt like he needed to be needed. But investigators thought that this evidence of an affair was quite substantial. They didn't have any doubts about it.
No, and as you read through this or watch the documentary, I mean, there isn't any question that an affair is going on.
No. Well, in the made-for-TV movie, it's very obvious.
It certainly is.
But, you know, those made-for-TV movies are not factual.
No.
You have to take those with some salt.
They're based on.
Right, right.
So Daryl Carter, this is the guy that had been paid $5,000 to arrange the hit. When he came forward, police were able to connect Tom Bird to Martin Anderson's murder. Now, Carter said that he met with Tom and Lorna at the church when they asked him to help kill Martin. This was the second person to come forward with a murder plot by Tom and Lorna. Tom said he only met with Daryl Carter to ask him to build a firecracker stand for a fundraiser, and Lorna had introduced them.
Never heard of a firecracker stand, by the way, but
me
that's
either.
Beside the point. Police set up a sting operation. So Daryl Carter wore a wire to secretly record a conversation with Tom Bird. During the conversation, Tom talked about the importance of being consistent about the firecracker story. Investigators believed that this 40-minute conversation revealed a clever and devious person carefully preparing an alibi with Daryl, who thought he was on his side, but he never really admitted to anything.
Yeah, so the whole point of the recording was to get Tom to admit that he was implicit in the crime.
Exactly.
And he never did.
No.
So they didn't get what they were looking for.
No, they kind of tried to act like it was a success, but it really wasn't that much of a success.
So Tom gets arrested 4 months after the murder, and he's arrested for criminal solicitation, not for the actual murder. Most of his church people believed he was innocent, and Tom pleaded not guilty. Prosecution laid out all the evidence of the affair as a motive for wanting Martin dead. Tom ended up taking the stand in his own defense. That's a rarity.
Yes.
And testified for 5 hours. He denied having an affair with Lorna, and he seemed to have answers for every question thrown at him. He was convicted of solicitation.
Yep, despite all that, I think the jury saw through him.
So he was sentenced to prison for 2.5 to 7 years. And Lorna later pleaded guilty to solicitation in the plot to kill her husband, and she got 5 to 18 years. There is no evidence that the contractor was Marty's actual killer, and police believe that Tom had actually done it himself. Now, 5 more years would go by before investigators gathered enough evidence to charge Tom and Lorna with murdering Marty Anderson. Remember, convictions were for solicitation to commit murder, not
yes.
the actual murder.
Exactly. Well, with the solicitation conviction, though, pressure really built to reexamine Sandy Bird's suspicious death.
I would think, right?
Absolutely. Her body was exhumed in 1984 and examined by Dr. William Eckert, a forensic pathologist, who concluded that she had been struck on the head repeatedly with a blunt object, and she died from a blow to her back, and that probably came about when she fell from the bridge into the river. 1.5 years after Sandy Bird's death, a grand jury charged Tom Bird with killing her, and this was a strong circumstantial case. So we're thinking about what really happened after the Birds left the babysitter that night. Tom told police that they had a drink at his church office and then went their separate ways. Sandy drove to her office at the university, and he stayed to go over the next day's sermon. He expected her to pick him up at the church later. The police received several calls from Tom before midnight, reporting his wife missing. But the babysitter said he didn't call home until after midnight to ask if Sandy had turned up or had called. Now, why would he call police before checking at home?
Good point.
Tom told police that after his wife dropped him off at the church, he went jogging, which he often did as a way to think over the next day's sermon. The babysitter remembered, though, that he came home in a shirt and a tie. Why would he change back into a suit to come home? The prosecutor suggested that Tom had jogged the 7 miles from the bridge and that his jogging clothes were probably dumped somewhere, covered with dirt and blood. Now, another piece of circumstantial evidence was the testimony of the sheriff's officer who delivered the bad news to Tom on the morning of the 17th.
Yeah, his reply gave him away because he said, "What was she doing there? We never go there." This was before even asking, "Where was she found?"
Yeah.
So that kind of tips the hand, doesn't it?
It certainly does. The only problem with that is you only have his word against that officer.
Right. So at Tom Byrd's conspiracy trial, the hitman, Daryl Carter, told the jury that the pastor had originally wanted him to kill Marty Anderson by sending his car off a cliff on a remote road to make it look like an accident. So that's pretty similar to how Sandy Byrd actually died.
Yeah, well, they certainly took notice of that.
So Sandy's family didn't want it to be true that Tom had killed Sandy, but the family wanted to know the truth, so they agreed to the exhumation for a second autopsy. So looking over the evidence from the initial investigation brought back into focus the finding of blood on the bridge and a tree in the leaves below the bridge. It was a year and a half after Sandy's death, and Tom Byrd was charged with first-degree murder.
Even though Tom Byrd was already in prison for criminal solicitation, he had a surprising amount of people from the congregation who still supported him and believed that he'd done nothing wrong. So when the second trial began, prosecutors set out to prove the affair as the motive for Sandy's murder, so that was a big part of the trial. Daryl Carter repeated his story about Tom conspiring to kill Marty the same way that Sandy had died. Several people testified that Sandy always wore her seatbelt, and this was despite Tom's claim that she only wore it when driving with the children in the car. Tom's defense was that Sandy's death was simply a tragic accident. He did not testify in his defense this time. After deliberating for 6 hours, jurors returned with a guilty verdict, so he was sentenced to life in prison.
The jury apparently didn't accept Tom's theory at the trial that Sandy had died as a result of a car accident. Now, later on, he claimed that there was newly discovered evidence showing she had committed suicide by purposely driving the car over the embankment.
A week before her death, Sandy and Tom Byrd were at a church conference with two couples who were friends of theirs. Al Boisan and Charles Smith, along with Tom, were ministers. Their wives, Pat Boisan and Carolyn Smith, were alone with Sandy one afternoon when Sandy started crying and said she was upset because Tom was spending too much time with his church secretary, Lorna Anderson. Sandy had lost weight and appeared to be depressed about her husband's relationships with other women. She told Carolyn and Pat about a time when a preschool teacher in Tom's church told her she used to wish Sandy would die in a car wreck so she would have Pastor Byrd for herself.
Oh, jeez.
So I guess Lorna's not the first one to have the hots for him.
No, it sounds like they're a perfect couple, Lorna and Tom.
Kind of sleazy.
Kind of sleazy. Extramarital affairs. Right.
Right. At another time during this conference, the Smiths and the Byrds were sitting around relaxing and having drinks when the talk turned, in a joking way, to the new life insurance policies the couples had obtained through the Lutheran Church. Pastor Smith made a remark to his wife that he would now have to watch out for her because she would do him in for the insurance money. Carolyn laughed and replied, "Well, I'd have to be very careful of how I do it." Everyone was having a good time and laughing, and Pastor Smith remembered that each person then stated what they thought the best way to kill themselves would be when there was insurance available. So Sandra Byrd made a comment that if she were ever to commit suicide, she would do it in a car, because then it would look like an accident and the insurance company would have to pay. Everyone laughed at that, and Carolyn Smith testified she considered the remark a joke that had added to a light-hearted conversation which she felt was rapidly degenerating.
Yeah, so when Carolyn Smith heard that Sandy had been killed in a car accident, her first thought was back to that meeting or that time when they were drinking, and she thought that it was a suicide. And she testified that suicide was her frame of reference because she'd had a painful experience in her past where a close friend had killed herself. And she called the Boisans and told them about Sandy's death and reminded them of Sandy's comment about suicide during the discussion of insurance at the conference. And then she asked, "She didn't do it, did she?"
Yeah, so that's they didn't know her that well, so they're just looking back on this one remark.
Yeah, I think that's kind of taken a little bit out of context.
Yes. Both the Smiths and the Boisons concluded that perhaps Sandy had committed suicide. Pastor Smith testified he believed Sandy committed suicide because he didn't think her death was an accident, and he didn't want to believe it was murder. So that was really the only option, the third option.
Right. I can't believe it was an accident. Her husband wouldn't kill her. So it must have been suicide.
Yeah.
Right.
He also told Mark Bird, Tom Bird's brother, and Irv Shaw, his defense attorney, his belief that it was suicide. Pastor Smith was called as a witness for Tom Bird at his murder trial in 1986, but no questions were asked regarding this possibility of suicide.
So why is that? They just didn't want to open up that whole discussion and have it shot down?
Yeah, I guess so.
Right.
In September 1984, Special Agent Humphrey of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation received a phone call from Mark Birchler, the chief of police in Marianna, Arkansas. Birchler had heard from a friend of Pastor Smith that Sandy had sent him a suicide note on the day of her death. Birchler thought that Smith was upset with Tom because he believed he had been unfaithful to Sandy. Agent Humphrey put this information in a report, which he gave to Tom Bird's attorneys. The information prompted Humphrey to travel to Tampa, Florida, to interview Pastor Smith to see if he had received such a note. Now, Humphrey found Smith had not received a note, but he had received another note from Sandy at the end of the conference. Now, at an appeal hearing, Pastor Smith recalled Sandy had written, "Dear Charlie, things are better now with Tom and I. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to talk with you this weekend, but I hope to in the future, Sandy."
Yeah, so, now that doesn't sound like a suicide note, does it?
No, not at all. Smith explained that Sandy had telephoned him, though, several times in the month leading up to her death, and talked about her anxiety over her husband's close relationship with Lorna Anderson.
There's more evidence that it was a murder.
Right.
Well, Agent Humphrey was interviewing Pastor Smith. Carolyn Smith came into the room, and she added to her husband's replies. Now, the agent found no inconsistencies between the husband's and wife's comments. Humphrey had titled his report as an interview with Pastor Smith and did not note in his report that he had also talked with Caroline Smith. Copy of the report was given to Bird's defense. Tom Bird's conviction was upheld. I guess this was on an appeal where he's seeking a new trial.
The state had brought forward no eyewitnesses. There was no physical evidence putting Tom at the scene. So the things that convicted him really were the babysitter's memory of the time Tom called home and the officer's memory of his comments the next morning. Now, the case didn't get much attention outside the state of Kansas until it was picked up by LA Times staff writer Scott Kraft. One of his first interviews was with John Rule, and that's the highway patrol trooper who discovered Sandy Bird's body.
Right. He plays a prominent role in the made-for-TV movie.
Well, yeah, it's Keith Carradine. He's kind of the star.
Yeah, but he wasn't that much of a figure in the actual case.
No, I think in the movie they kind of picked an interesting character and built the story around him. In the movie, they even go into his personal life, and
right.
It's all just a drama.
It is.
He did surprise Kraft when he told him that he had voiced suspicions about the accident from day one.
Right, according to the movie, he sure did.
Well, no, I mean in the interview with the LA Times writer. He said that.
Yep.
Okay. He said he started feeling hinky about the whole thing because he couldn't find any skid marks or signs of an attempt by the driver to stop. Also, he found Sandy's watch under the bridge, and there were the drops of blood on the bridge and the puddle of blood and some drops of blood on the tree leaves below. So he really thought something had happened on the bridge, which made sense. Now, this was in the 80s, so there wasn't any DNA testing to see if that was her blood. But
well, they could tell it was her blood type.
I don't think they were able to type it. They were able to say it was human blood is all I could get from it. But even if you type it, that's not going to say it's hers.
No.
No.
Just that they share the same blood type.
Yeah, which would narrow it down.
A little.
Yeah, not a lot.
Right.
But by the late morning, the evidence was scattered. Workers had trampled into the river and removed her body and the car. And Trooper Rule said he felt certain that she hadn't been in a car accident. But he didn't have the resources to prove it, and the detectives thought it was an accident. He was also troubled by the driver's seat in the car being pushed far back, too far for Sandy Bird, who was only 5'1", to have been driving. Also, when he interviewed her friends, they said she always wore a seatbelt. Now, she couldn't have been ejected from the car, obviously, if she had her seatbelt on. There'd been an immediate assumption that Sandy had been drunk after police found the cold duck bottle in the car. But her toxicology results showed a level well below the legal limit, so she wasn't drunk. Now, Emporia is a town of 25,000 people near the Flint Hills, so that's a stretch of treeless plains in east-central Kansas. Faith Lutheran, Tom Bird's former church, still has Sunday worshipers coming in. The crime scene is no longer called Rocky Ford Bridge. These days, everybody calls it Bird Bridge.
So Gwendolyn Larson, who covers police and court doings for the Emporia Gazette newspaper, said, "This county believes in justice. Whether they got it is a question. Some people think they didn't, some think they did." Well, that's kind of a dumb statement.
Okay.
So Tom Bird still has people who believe he is innocent.
Sure he does, including himself.
Well, yeah. So Terry Bird married Tom in a prison ceremony in 1988.
Now Dave Racer wrote Caged Bird, and that's a self-published book that argues Tom Bird was convicted on flimsy circumstantial evidence in a town that was hell-bent on justice. So they also believe that the movie Murder Ordained made Tom look guilty and it was unfair. Now, Terry Bird worked at a Lutheran school in Kansas City, Kansas. She has a master's degree in education with a specialty in teaching children with learning disabilities. She actually met Tom Bird at a church function shortly after Sandy died.
And didn't Lorna, while Tom was in prison, didn't she marry someone else?
She did.
You going to talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, never mind.
Tom Bird has acknowledged in interviews that he and Sandy were having marital troubles in 1983. He says he supported Sandy's career, but they had disagreements about how much time each of them was spending with their jobs. In response to the evidence against him, he said he put on a polo shirt after his run, and maybe the babysitter was confused, thinking he wore a suit when he came home. And also he said the babysitter was wrong about the time that he called, that it was earlier. The babysitter had said he called at 1 a.m. He said he called before midnight. Campus and city police records showed he had called them earlier. Tom said he called police after calling home. So his story's not meshing with the police or the babysitters, and I think that's why it didn't work at trial.
I think so. Now, he remembered the morning the deputy sheriff delivered the news of his wife's death differently also. Deputy gave a general description of the accident location. He said about 4 miles outside Emporia. Tom told him he and his wife had never been there.
The prosecution theory was that Sandy and Tom went to the river together, got out of the car, and walked onto the bridge to talk. There, Tom beat her and forced her off the bridge. Tom then pushed the car from the road down into the river next to her. Tom maintained that he didn't know what had happened to his wife. He suggested that it was possible she was depressed or careless. "I don't know whether it was an accident or suicide or a murder," he told Scott Kraft. "All I know is that I didn't kill Sandy."
Yeah, now he did admit that the facts don't support an accident. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe Lorna Anderson or one of her former boyfriends had something to do with that. But there is no evidence to support that.
He's kind of turned on Lorna there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. She didn't wait for him. She married. In describing his relationship with Lorna, Tom said there was a need to be needed, and he liked the idea of being needed. So he unprofessionally let an inappropriate relationship develop. So does that mean he's still disclaiming an affair, or that they had a close relationship?
Well, a few months after he wrote the notes to Lorna in early 1984, after both of their spouses were dead, and not before, as Lorna claimed, he said they did become lovers. He said they were intimate 3 or 4 times before his arrest in March 1984, and he was sorry about that. He was weak. Now, in the movie Murder Ordained, Tom persuades Lorna that it's less evil to kill than to divorce their spouses. But in his interview, Tom said that was preposterous and laughable. He believed the movie kept him in prison. He was a model inmate, though, in prison. He co-founded Convicts for Christ, and he organized a tennis marathon to raise money for the Ronald McDonald House. He and Terry started a marriage enrichment seminar in 1988 for inmates and their spouses.
Yeah, so the case came down to Tom Bird's word against the prosecution's case, built on an incomplete investigation the testimony of the 14-year-old babysitter, his lack of an alibi, and his relationship with Lorna Anderson.
So it was a few years after the movie in 1990 when Tom went on trial for first-degree murder in the death of Marty. Lorna Anderson pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in exchange for her testimony against Tom.
So now we're putting people on trial for Marty Anderson's murder.
Well, Tom Bird. Lorna pleaded guilty.
She had already pled out.
Lorna said she and Tom had planned the killing together and that Tom was the masked man who actually gunned down Marty. So this was different. So there's still some question of who was the actual gunman. Daryl Carter denied having any part in the murder of Marty Anderson. When he was approached by Lorna and Tom, he said they told him they were in love and they asked him to kill Marty so they could be together. Daryl had quite reasonably suggested that the Andersons get a divorce instead. Tom Bird responded that Lorna didn't want a divorce because then she couldn't collect money from her husband's life insurance policy. Marty had taken out a $270,000 policy earlier that year. The lovers proposed two ways of killing Marty. One involved drugging him and shoving his car into a river to make his death look like an accident. The other was to shoot and kill him in what would appear to be a robbery. And initially they wanted that done at a relative's home where Marty was staying when he went to Topeka for his Army Reserve activities. But Daryl Carter later testified that Tom told him no one would suspect that he was involved just because he was a minister.
Well, sure.
So he kind of thought he was above the law, right?
Well, a minister doesn't kill people, right?
Not usually, but most people don't usually kill people.
Now, gossip had started to fly in Emporia soon after Lorna took the part-time job in January 1983 as secretary at the Faith Lutheran Church.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It was something that was kind of known around town.
Yeah, it wasn't kind of common knowledge.
Some members felt concerned that this attractive, married mother of four was in a romantic relationship with their popular minister, who was also married and a father of three. Church preschool director Angie Dunsing later testified that there was a spark in their eyes and electricity in the air when Tom and Lorna were together. She said she'd seen him touch arms with other women before, but never hug them like he did with Lorna. Tom responded to concerned church members by saying he was helping Lorna, who was suicidal and got a feeling of self-worth from her job.
Now, a church member named Jan Mead knew what was going on, because she saw Lorna regularly as part of her job with the American Heart Association, where Lorna also did volunteer work. Jan knew that Lorna was unhappily married and had been lovers with her hairdresser, Daniel Carter, who was Daryl's brother.
Back in February of 1983, Jan testified, Lorna told her that she'd fallen in love with Tom, who was pretty good in bed for a minister.
Well, that's high praise, isn't it?
I think so. Jan suggested that the Andersons get a divorce, but Lorna told her that her husband was a good father to the children. She also said that it sounded really awful, but sometimes she wished something would happen to Marty and to Tom's wife so Tom and her could spend the rest of their lives together. Tom and Lorna met back in May 1983 with 39-year-old Daryl Carter, and they asked him to kill Marty, but he said he put off giving them an answer. The longer I sat there and listened to two people talk about killing a friend, I started getting pretty nervous about it, Daryl said. I didn't want to give them my answer. I wasn't too sure that then I'd be leaving the church myself. So Daryl said he called Tom in late May and said he wanted nothing to do with the murder. He later testified that he chose not to contact authorities because he thought nothing would happen. But then during the early morning hours of July 17th, Tom's wife of 12 years was killed. Tom was acquitted and no one else had been charged in Marty Anderson's death.
So he got off on the murder of Marty Anderson.
He did, and the thing is that Lorna got a deal to testify against him.
Deal.
But then he was acquitted.
Yeah.
So nobody's been convicted of that.
Well, Lorna was convicted of second-degree murder.
Yes, but who was the shooter?
We don't know.
She says it was actually Tom.
Probably was.
Well, he was acquitted of that.
He was, wasn't he?
Yes. So some people believe that Daryl testified to save his brother Daniel, that Daniel was the shooter. And others think that Tom was the shooter, but nobody's paying for it.
Nope. So Tom Bird was paroled in June 2004, despite the pleas from Sandy's family that he remain in prison. He went to live in Wyandotte County with his wife, Terry. He got released from parole supervision in 2006. Now, all his children were adopted by Sandy's brother.
Who wants nothing to do with him?
Not at all.
For 2 decades, Tom adamantly denied having an affair with Lorna, and then it was in 2007 that he admitted to having the physical relationship. But he said it was after both the spouses died, and it was just a comforting thing. He's never admitted to...
Don't go there, Jesus.
Well, he's never admitted to having an affair.
I know, but still.
Lorna was denied requests for early parole in the fall 2004, even though Tom was let out. That was only one of many denials since she became parole eligible in 1988. So she was denied parole in 88, 95, 97, 98, and 2000. And she was out in 2006. Then she was actually released from her parole supervision in 2014.
So they're both out and not even being supervised.
I don't understand why they're both out and living their lives. But her name was Lorna Eldridge when she was first sentenced because she'd married a guy named Randy Eldridge in 85. And then they got divorced in 1990. Then she took back her maiden name and she was Lorna Slater. Then she married a guy named Terry Moore, who was a former employee of a child welfare organization, and she married him while she was in prison as well.
That's interesting. They're both married to people named Terry.
I know, isn't that funny? So Lorna Moore is her name now, and she became the new CEO of Interfaith Housing Services in Hutchinson's, Kansas, just this year, and that's 11 years after she was released from prison. She was 32 when she went to prison in 1985. She said that she was thrown a lifeline by a group of women with the United Methodist Women's Ministry, Women for Justice and Mercy. After several years, Lorna began to realize that even prison brought her some opportunities, so she took parenting classes for women in prison. This United Methodist Women group made sure that mothers were always staying in touch with their kids, even though they were in prison. Then Lorna became an instructor for the course. She earned a college degree with honors from the University of St. Mary. Now, I always feel like it's easy to get a college degree in prison. You don't have to pay bills or deal with life. It's all you have to do.
Right.
And you don't have to pay tuition either. So they get a better deal than people on the outside.
But still, she attended college and got a college degree.
She did.
Kudos to her.
I guess there are other things she could do.
It sounds like she's turned things around a little bit. So eventually, the women leading the prison ministry decided the inmates should start their own UMW chapter. The group began doing fundraisers like walkathons and making quilts for foster kids and battered women. And leading the group as its first president was Lorna Moore.
So at the time of the murders, Lorna's daughters were 8 and 4, and the younger ones, the twins, were 2. As she tried to explain her relationship with Reverend Thomas Byrd, it wasn't an easy topic for her. So she said it's hard for her to understand how she got into the situation in a recent interview. She said that she and Marty didn't have a happy marriage, but things turned worse, and she claims that Marty was physically abusive, although she said she doesn't want to use that as an excuse, because she does admit that she knew he was going to be shot and she intentionally pulled the car over and was part of the whole ruse to get him killed. And in this recent interview, she also said that Tom Byrd was the actual killer, the shooter that day. But Lorna and Tom, they never spoke to each other once they were in prison. So I guess it wasn't true love.
I guess not. They didn't stand by each other.
No, and true love lasts forever.
It does. I had a lot of opportunities while I was incarcerated, Lorna said, and this included marrying again. So Terry Moore, her last husband, most recent husband.
Current,
okay. He knew of Lorna Anderson before he visited her in prison. He was campus director of Youthville in Newton and also worked with Florence Crittenden Services, where one of Lorna's daughters was living. He took her to the prison to visit Lorna. Then he made several return visits with Lorna's daughter, and it wasn't long before the couple realized they had a lot in common.
So maybe this one was true love.
It almost, I hate to say it, but it almost sounds like a happy ending.
Well, except for the dead people and the people that love
right,
the dead people.
That's the bad part.
I think that Lorna probably turned her life around.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Tom.
No, but I mean, do they really deserve to be out? Because I'm sure there are plenty of people who murdered and then turned their lives around who will still be in prison forever.
They will be.
Will die in prison. So they really lucked out, I guess.
Yeah, I think they did.
Maybe they made the best of the situation, or at least she did, but I don't know. That makes me wonder.
It does.
Yeah.
But in, I like her quote that it's hard for me to understand how I got into that situation. And I can see in hindsight, you wonder, how could I have done that? How could I have done what I did? I must have been nuts.
Well, and it almost makes me think of cults, because this was a charismatic church leader. So I could see how he probably lured her in.
Well, I'm not going to go that far.
No. I think he was influential, for sure.
Well, yeah. But she'd had affairs before, so I think she probably looked at him as just another fling.
Oh, no. She was in love with him. She was going to leave her whole family to be with him and start a new ministry.
Maybe. That's what he was thinking.
That's what she was thinking, too, I think. I think that, at least at the time, she thought it was quite serious.
Okay. But then look back on it and say, how the hell did I ever do that?
Yeah, it just took such a destructive path.
Yeah.
And I guess as objective people, we can say, sure, it was a happy ending. They turned themselves around. But if I'm Sandy's mother, I'm like, no, they should be in prison.
Yeah, they should be.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, either you're going to give everybody a chance or nobody gets a chance. And I feel like these people got chances other people didn't get.
Well, they certainly did.
Yeah. Okay, we have a short feedback section today, but before then, I'd just like to take a moment to tell our listeners how wonderful they are. We've received many wishes for a joyous 2018 and so many interesting case suggestions to make some very good True Crime Brewery episodes this year. I was surprised by how many of you joined Team Tie Grabber over the holidays, and many of you offered additional support by purchasing merchandise from our brewery shop. Thank you. For those of you who are Tie Grabber members and those of you considering it, we're working hard at getting the premium episodes out to you frequently and to try and cover cases that are interesting to you. We have 14 premium episodes now available on the Tie Grabber TCB premium feed. Recently, we covered the very mysterious case of the Grimes sisters, who were missing and found murdered in the Chicago area way back in the 1950s. One thing I found is that a lot of things have changed since then as far as forensics, but human nature is pretty much the same. Dick and I are now immersing ourselves in the story of Philip Markoff, a young, handsome medical student up here in Boston who became known as the Craigslist Killer. This is truly a fascinating case, and we should have an episode covering it for Tie Grabber members within the next week or so.
I would think, because we're just about done with the research.
Yep. So our podcast Watching ID has also been catching on, and I'm sure many of our True Crime Brewery listeners are the people that are listening to Watching ID, right?
Absolutely.
Investigation Discovery's Village of the Dam just finished its fifth episode in its five-episode run, and we have our take on episodes 3, 4, and 5 out this week. If you haven't already listened, our coverage of episodes 1 and 2 has been available for a while now, so that's Watching ID if you're interested in that. So just to rehash, thank you for being awesome. Join Team Tie Grabber because the Philip Markoff Craigslist Killer episode is coming up. And check out Watching ID, whether or not you actually do watch ID. We watch it for you and recap so you can listen as a compliment to watching the shows, or just listen and we'll tell you all about the show you didn't see, plus our very in-depth opinions on it. Well-educated.
Always well-educated, in-depth, thoughtful. Concise.
Yes.
You name it, we got it.
That's right. And, oh yes, our Create a TCB T-shirt design contest is still going on. So send your design in PNG or JPG format to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. We're going to make a decision in February, and the winner gets $250 and the first shirt that comes off the presses.
Yeah, we've had some great entries. We've had a real run lately and some really good ones.
Yeah, so, I think as the end of it approaches, we're getting more and more.
Yeah, don't hesitate. Get your stuff in.
No, definitely.
So on to feedback. I have a letter from Katie Y. about our podcast. She says she's always been interested in true crime and have listened to most of the podcasts in this genre. You are fast becoming my absolute favorite. I love hearing the discussion between the two of you. I enjoy hearing a husband-wife perspective along with the expertise of a medical doctor. Your opinions are both fair and well-researched. Now, Katie goes on to say, I've never fully appreciated beer, with the exception of Belgian beers, which I now understand why, as I love all the background information given with the recommendations. See? People do like my beer reviews.
They do.
Keep up the great work. I am a North Dakota, Minnesota gal and would love to hear your take on the Drew Shodin, S-J-O-D-I-N case in Grand Forks, North Dakota. So, looking this up, and I'd heard of this, or I think we've even watched it on Dateline or something before. So, Drew was a student at the University of North Dakota who disappeared in November of 2003 after finishing her shift at Victoria's Secret in the Columbia Mall of Grand Forks, North Dakota. She is talking on her cell phone with her boyfriend as she was leaving the mall and just stopped abruptly.
Oh.
And the boyfriend thought that the call had been dropped or something.
Sure.
But then she didn't show up at her next job, and people got concerned. So she's gone missing. She's not found. A week after she went missing, a registered sex offender named Alfonso Rodriguez Jr. was arrested for Drew's disappearance. He had been released from prison 6 months previously for assault and attempted kidnapping of a woman and had been previously found guilty of rape. She was found in April of 2004, so 5 months later, when snows were melting, they found her body near a house where Rodriguez lived with his mother.
Oh.
So, and he was convicted.
It doesn't sound at all familiar to me, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, I think we should look into that.
Okay. And you really didn't have to read all that flattery beforehand, but I usually just read the suggestion.
Oh, okay.
It was very nice. Not that I don't like to hear it. I love to hear it. But I don't know if listeners really care to hear our praise.
I was being thorough.
I know.
Reading the whole letter. I thought Katie wanted her whole letter read.
She probably did. I'm sure she's happy.
I did that for Katie.
All right. Well, thanks, Katie. It was really nice stuff to say. It's not that we don't appreciate it. We really do. I just don't want to bore other listeners by saying nice things about ourselves.
Yeah, well, this is an aw shucks moment.
Okay. We can have one once in a while, I guess.
Right.
Especially about the beer reviews, because we get so many people who don't like them. When someone does like them, it's really nice.
We seem to have a fair amount of people that just don't like beer.
Well, that's the thing.
So I don't give a hoot about the beer review.
Yeah, I wouldn't take it personally.
Okay.
They're just listening for the crime story.
Just skip through the beer review.
Yeah, and that's what they do, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But then other people really enjoy it, so I think that's good. So what I'm going to talk about is an email I got from Chuck R., and it's a case recommendation. He says he enjoys our show and looks forward to Tuesdays. He ran across the most entertaining case that he thought we might enjoy adding to our lineup, with plenty of twists and dogged police work to bring the killer to justice. I found an article on this. It's called Beheading in Mount Baldy. Or I didn't find it. He actually gave me the link to it, and I followed the link. And it really is fascinating. This is an article in LA Weekly back from 2005. And I've perused it. I haven't read the complete thing yet, but it really does seem like a multifaceted case that would be worth doing an episode about. There's certainly plenty of information. It reminds me a little bit of the IHOP murders in how twisted it is, how it's got the...
Wow. Okay.
But anyway, it's about this guy, Jack Irwin, who was living in a cabin off by himself. He was a veteran, and he ended up buying a house. He was living like in the woods in a cabin, and he had money put away. He went out and bought a house with cash because he was cold and he felt like being more comfortable, I guess. He moved into this house, and then he met these two women who were a lesbian couple, and what he did is he kind of gave them a deal on his cabin, and they got closer and closer with him. They ended up moving in together, I think, and just kind of taking over his whole life. So these two women moved in with him, and they started bossing him around.
Okay.
And he started living his life the way that they wanted him to, I guess.
So they were the dominant pair.
Yes. So there's a lot of background about these two women, which would be great to delve into, about their childhoods and what made them who they were. And after a time, Jack decides to put his money all in a trust for them because he doesn't have any family. He says to his neighbor, I think it was, that if he dies, he wants them to have everything, and if they die, he'll get everything. So the neighbor thinks this is nuts. He shouldn't do this.
Well, yeah. Again, these are people he's fairly recently met.
Yeah.
Right?
But he's like in this web with them.
Yeah.
And he does that. So then, of course, he comes up missing.
Well, I would have predicted that, right?
Kind of, yeah. In our line of work, you would.
Yeah.
So anyway, he comes up missing. They start buying stuff, spending all his money. And there's an elder abuse person, professional, who comes in and starts doing some investigating. Probably, you know, neighbors and things have said something's going on here.
Right.
What they decide is that they need to put together a murder case. Well, I guess the lesbians have some kind of falling out at some point, and one of them gets a new girlfriend and confesses to her that they had killed him, cut him into little pieces, and put him like in Tupperware in the freezer, like in little separate portions like food.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. And I don't know what they did with his head, but the name of the story is Beheading on Mount Baldy, so it probably says in there, I just haven't read the complete story.
The head is separate.
I would imagine.
So they found all these body parts in Tupperware in a freezer?
Well, I don't know if they found them, but she confessed to her girlfriend that that's what they did.
Yeah.
And that's where I didn't read any further into the story.
That's fascinating.
But yes.
Put that on the list.
Yeah, I'm going to put this probably at the top of the list. I think it's going to bypass some other stories because this is fascinating stuff.
It sounds very interesting.
It has so many facets to it. The financial crimes, the relationship between the two women, then the relationship with the one woman and the new woman, then the two women get back together and they have problems with the other woman, with threatening her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So all this right. is a great story, really.
Sign me up.
Yeah. So thank you, Chuck. That is one of the best stories we've received. And we're definitely going to cover it. We could probably fit it in March. I've got an opening in March.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
We'll do it.
All right.
So I got a final one. This is a slower week for feedback.
Sure.
This is from Misty M. in Lincolnton, North Carolina. Hi, Jill. I love your podcast. There's a story that happened in my state, North Carolina. It's actually just a town over from where I live. There are many places to research the story, but here's the Wikipedia page. And we've had this before. I mean, at least it sounds familiar. This is involving a single dad from Wagga Wagga, Australia, who meets a woman named Elisa online, and Elisa lives in Hickory, North Carolina. He takes his daughter Zara and moves to the state. They marry, unbeknownst to the father, Adam. Elisa is already married to him.
What?
So
you lost me there.
So
the guy comes over from Australia.
Guy from Australia comes over, marries a woman named Elisa.
Sure.
Except she's already married to a guy named Adam.
So how'd they get married?
They just did. So the marriage wasn't legal. And it turns out that Elisa had been married 6 times before.
Wow.
So Zara, the daughter, was a cancer survivor, and she had a prosthetic leg.
So whose daughter is this?
This is the guy from Australia's daughter.
He brought her with him?
Brought her with him.
Okay.
Now, she was abused, killed, and dismembered by Elisa. Her little body parts, including the prosthetic leg, were scattered around, but eventually found. They could not find the cause of death because of the amount of decomposition of the body.
So where was the dad?
Dad was in North Carolina.
And he didn't know about it? Or he's in on it?
He's in on it.
Oh, God.
Misty thinks we'd do a wonderful job telling this story.
Yeah, I think someone has suggested that before.
We've had this suggested before, and I think it's on our radar.
Yeah.
Maybe not immediate, but it's something that we're going to be doing.
Maybe we'll move it up a little. I mean, I think if we can do it in a way to show some respect and acknowledgement to the little girl and what she went through, then I'm willing to do it.
Okay. Well, let's do some research.
That would have to be the focus. So.
And see what we want to do.
Yeah, if we could get some, I don't know who her biological mother was, if there's somebody we'd be able to contact.
Yeah, it just says a single father from Australia.
So that might be worth looking into. So thanks, everybody, for your feedback. We'll be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, if you join Tie Grabber, we have the Philip Markoff case coming up. And we also have new episodes on Watching ID, where we watch TV shows on the Investigation Discovery Network, and then we talk about them.
We do. That's our job. And I'd also would say it's the first episode of the new year, so happy 2018, everybody.
Yes. Let's have high hopes for this year.
We do.
Okay, good.
We always start off with high hopes.
All right. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you at the quiet end.
Come join us.